It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A Milwaukee area health insurance co-op is set to become part of an Ohio health insurance company. It's a move that means leaving the Affordable Care Act government marketplace. We examine shifts underway in the health insurance industry, and we hear from you. Call in with a question, share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy Mahaffey is CEO of Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative. That's a Brookfield-based health insurer she founded in 2012. Kathy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. Well, let's start by giving us some working knowledge. How is a health insurance cooperative different from other health insurance companies?
Yeah, so Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative is both a federal co-op and a Wisconsin cooperative. And that makes us somewhat unique because we are really focused on the members that we serve, and we're nonprofit, but we're also consumer oriented and operated. So our members who buy our health insurance actually elect our board of directors, and they really have a say in the way that we operate.
And what is that like? I mean, do members have, what type of leverage do members have of this health insurance co-op that is consumer operated and oriented?
Yeah. So we have a board of directors. Actually, we have 9 voting board members, and every year our members elect those 9 folks to serve on our board. And I work very closely with our board to make decisions, decisions that impact the people who choose to purchase our health insurance. You know, those decisions can be anywhere from, every year the board of directors approves our premium increases or decreases that we've had over the years, different benefit offerings. And most importantly, we really take into account the feedback we receive from our members. And we get member feedback in a variety of ways, and we bring that into the organization so that we can make ourselves a better health plan, because we really just exist for our members. We don't have any outside shareholders or other owners. So it really makes us centrally focused on the people that we serve. So we call ourselves a very member-centered organization.
So do these members who stay in the co-op longer for their health insurance, do they gain any additional benefits or additional ownership stake?
No, there's no ownership stake in the cooperative by our members, in terms of, being true somehow financially related ownership, but it's just really the way that we operate again. We're stronger when we have more members, gives us that purchasing power, if you will, as we need to negotiate with either vendors to provide services to our members or our provider partners. Really the concept of a cooperative is just bringing people together, people that, are here for the, we're all here for the same reason, which is to have a very robust health insurance offering, have premiums be as affordable as we can make them. So it's really just kind of a different way of operating.
What attracts you to the nonprofit health insurance setting and this type of model for healthcare delivery?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been in health insurance my entire career. And when I first started in health insurance, I really just needed a job when I graduated college to pay back my student loan. But, I quickly learned that people do not often look favorably upon health insurance. And that really bothered me when I started out my career. And it really wasn't until I landed at a cooperative. This is my 3rd cooperative I've actually worked at. So early in my career, I landed at a cooperative in Madison, and I could see the difference that, a cooperative really exists for the sole purpose of serving its members and really nothing else. And so I was really drawn to that model. I thought, wow, I can be in this industry and do really good for people. So this is, as I said, my 3rd cooperative. It's my 2nd startup cooperative. And I really, really like working in this environment.
Kathy Mahaffey is with us, a CEO of Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative, as we discuss the health insurance industry. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Okay, Kathy, we're going back in time when the federal government gives 24 nonprofit insurers more than $2 billion in loans to improve competition in the Affordable Care Act health insurance marketplaces. Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative is now one of the three nonprofit insurers remaining today. Why did this particular cooperative succeed when more than 20 others failed?
Yeah, you know, it was really difficult at the beginning, you know, of the Affordable Care Act. Of course, the ACA, as we call it, or Obamacare, you know, it's done a lot of great things for consumers. But in those early days, you know, it was pretty rocky. You know, the Affordable Care Act came in and was going to really change up health insurance. You know, people no longer had to worry about pre-existing conditions and all of those things. And so, you know, there was this idea to have these federal co-ops be infused into the marketplace so that they'd bring more competition and a different model, you know, a nonprofit consumer, you know, focused model. But it was rocky, as I said, and some of the kind of the key components of the Affordable Care Act, such as some dollars to help health insurance companies with kind of to stabilize things with the ACA, they didn't come through. So there were you know, millions of dollars that were owed to health plans across the country, not just federal co-ops, but all health plans that, you know, ended up not coming through. And so a lot of the co-ops across the country just simply couldn't make their way through that. And for us, you know, we were able to find a way. You know, every time we were presented with an obstacle, we just kept fighting and finding a way through so that we could keep this great, you know, business model going for our members. And, you know, it's just a series of things that happened over those years. But again, you know, we had great partnerships with our healthcare providers. They wanted us here in the market. And, you know, our board of directors and our members were so committed to what we were doing. So we just found a way, I guess, and every time there was an obstacle.
In within these obstacles, what was so rocky? I mean, there sometimes people think of health insurance and the industry making significant significant amounts of capital and a lot of profit. What was different here?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. People do, you know, that is a common perception of the industry. But so for our experience, you know, we were a startup, and anyone who started any type of business, they know how hard that can be. And so we were awarded a loan from the federal government to start Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative. But when we launched in 2014, that was our first entry into health insurance. That's when the Affordable Care Act started. And like every health plan kind of across the country, we didn't know what to expect. You know, how many members would enroll? What would their health risk profile look like? And this was very common where the folks that were, you know, entering the Affordable Care Act, the, you know, individuals and families, you know, they had a higher risk profile. They had more claims than, you know, premium was being paid in. And so that just resulted in, you know, losses because you have to be able to have enough premiums to pay for all of that. And so the ACA, though, had some great premium stabilization programs. In fact, they had three of them. But there were, you know, some things that happened politically. And one of those programs in particular, called the Risk Corridor Program, did not have enough funds to help out health plans across the country. And then there was no way that those funds were going to be provided to health plans either. Mm. So, you know, instead of getting, you know, a dollar, for example, that health plans were due in that program, we received 12 cents on that dollar. So that was really significant. It was significant for us and certainly all the co-ops because, again, we were startups, So we didn't have a lot of funds, and we didn't have other product lines or things that we can fall back on. And so, it also, not only impacted the co-ops, but it generally did impact health insurance companies across the country. In Wisconsin, for example, insurance companies started exiting Wisconsin, not participating in the Affordable Care Act. So again, it was just a really rocky time.
Kathy Mahaffey is CEO of Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative. That's a Brookfield-based health insurer, as we discuss changes in the healthcare insurance industry. Call in with a question. Add your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About a decade ago, the federal government awarded about $2 billion in startup loans to help create 24 healthcare co-ops to offer coverage plans on the Affordable Care Act marketplaces. That history is from the journal Health Affairs, and we explore one of the last remaining health co-ops that will dissolve and become part of a nonprofit health insurance firm in Ohio. Kathy Mahaffey is CEO of Brookfield-based Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective, 800-642-1234. So, Kathy, bring us up to date here. Why join with this other Ohio-based nonprofit healthcare insurer?
Sure. We love what we do. We love serving individuals and families in eastern Wisconsin, and we fully intend to do that. I want to make sure our members know and people know that we intend to continue to offer health insurance for years and years to come to individuals and families. But we knew a few years ago our board of directors had said, it's probably important for us to explore partnerships, because we are a smaller health plan. And it's can be challenging, financially, can be challenging operationally to operate. And we so much love, our mission of putting members first that we said, let's try to find a like-minded partner so that we can continue this mission and strengthen our health plan. And so that's really kind of how we got started on the search for a partner. And I've talked to a lot of different organizations over the last few years, but when CareSource came our way, it was kind of like we knew instantly that this other nonprofit health plan could really help us continue our mission.
But meanwhile, the ACA marketplace is growing. In January, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services reported that a record high 21.3 million people selected a plan on the ACA during the 2024 open enrollment period. So why leave this segment as it continues to grow?
Oh, and we're not leaving the segment.
Okay.
So I really want to make sure everyone knows that Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative will continue to serve individuals and families in the on the marketplace. We intend to do that now and for years and years and years to come. Really, what we're doing is, again, looking for we're looking for that partner to help us strengthen our organization and grow even further. And so, while we won't be a federal co-op, that is what we're looking to exit that federal co-op program. We will still be a licensed health insurance carrier in Wisconsin serving individuals and families, but we will be affiliating with CareSource to help us grow.
So, in order to terminate the co-op and join the Ohio nonprofit CareSource, what financial hurdles do you have to overcome in doing that?
We really don't have financial hurdles to overcome. But as we've been talking about, we did receive a loan from the federal government to start Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative. And we have fully paid back our startup loan portion of that. And we have paid back about half of our solvency loan as well. So we have certain payments we have to make every year, and we're current on all of that. So when we put our request in to exit the federal co-op program, if we do get all the approvals that are necessary to affiliate with CareSource, then we'll pay back the remaining portion of our loan. So that's just part of the, I guess, the steps in the process here to affiliate with CareSource. But we have the reserves to do that, so no concerns about that.
And what I'm hearing from you, Kathy, is that your plan offerings wouldn't shift more to Ohio healthcare systems.
No, thanks for asking that. We will remain a local Wisconsin licensed health plan. We'll be here locally in Brookfield. Our members love to stop at our office, pay their premiums, ask questions to our member services representatives, and all of that's remaining. So we'll continue to be a local, have local presence, but we'll just have the resources and the backing of another really, well, another members first nonprofit health plan. So we'll be able to offer our members more services, and more financial stability, all of those things, so that we can, again, be here for years to come.
We're talking about a health insurance industry and a cooperative based in Brookfield. Kathy Mahaffey is CEO of Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative. Call in with questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy, looking more broadly at healthcare delivery, we've been following the reporting on two hospitals that are set to close in western Wisconsin this spring. How do hospital and clinic closures affect health insurers like your co-op, for instance?
We're certainly fortunate in eastern Wisconsin, where we operate in 24 counties on the east side of the state. That we haven't experienced those, and we certainly are hopeful that we don't have more of those. There's no doubt that there are challenges for hospital systems, and whether it range from staffing or financial challenges. And so it's really difficult to see, and when they're forced to end operations. That's hard for patients, it's hard for the communities. And so, I'm hoping that we can take some learnings from what happened in Western Wisconsin and just say, what can we do to prevent those things from happening?
What is the legacy of Affordable Care Act health insurance cooperatives? What were the, surprising teachable moments here?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kate. As you said at the beginning, there were 24 that received a loan, 23 that launched, and today there's three left. And I often get asked, would you consider that, a su successful program? And, certainly we would never be here today without the federal co-op program and the loan that we received. And so we're very grateful for that. I mean, we have served tens of thousands of people in the 10 years that the Affordable Care Act has been in existence. And so we feel, again, very grateful for that loan. And we know it had an impact on our members and on the insurance industry in Wisconsin. Again, bringing that consumer-focused type of health plan, we think our members have really had a different experience. So the legacy here of the three remaining is, again, just really wanting to, examine, having a different type of model, that is just entirely focused on the people that it serves and not any other stakeholders that you need to really focus on and perhaps redirect your efforts to serve those other than your members.
In our last moments together, I just want to pick your brain and get your thoughts. I mean, there's been this push for removing the profit motive from healthcare and supporting a single-payer system in the U.S. and public options. Could that type of system work in this country?
I think that there is just a lot I think we have to do first before we're ready for that type of system. I think there are, I think Wisconsin's very lucky. There's a lot of wonderful community-based, local health plans. So we are a bit unique, you know, where we're not dominated by one or two large for-profit, you know, national insurance carriers. But I think that, you know, our system is broken in many ways, and I think we really need to. I think there's a lot of things we can do to improve it, especially at the local level. And so I'd like to see more efforts in that regard before we necessarily say that, you know, that perhaps would be the solution.
Kathy, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Kathy Mahaffey is CEO of Brookfield-based Common Ground Healthcare Cooperative. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We find out what it's like to run a dog sled team through the Alaskan wilderness with a pair of Wisconsin teens who recently completed the Junior Iditarod. First, we learn about the response to reckless driving in Milwaukee. This year, the city is funding $86 million in street redesign projects. Evan Casey has more on what else local leaders are doing to tackle the issue.
On a warm summer day in 2021, Julie Wellinger's son went out to grab snacks at the gas station with his friends. She had just laid down for a nap when a neighbor knocked on her door.
She said there's been a terrible accident. They don't think there's any survivors.
Wellinger's 22-year-old son, Gerald, and his friend both died after the car they were in was hit by two drivers racing down the street. It's been almost 3 years since the crash.
When I hear sirens going by, I get... My heart starts to beat really heavy because I'm thinking, what if it's someone else getting in an accident?
Unfortunately, Wellinger's story isn't unique. Since the pandemic, Milwaukee has averaged more than 70 traffic deaths per year. Risky driving behavior has increased nationally in that time, too. But in Milwaukee, experts say wide lanes of traffic and high speed limits aren't helping the issue. This year, the city will spend around $86 million on street safety improvements to help lower speeds. That's as much as it's spent on the issue in the last 4 years combined. On the corner of Burleigh and Fond du Lac, the risky driving behavior is easy to spot. Drivers are running red lights and swerving in and out of parking lanes to get around traffic. Many pedestrians and drivers have learned to live with it. Community activist Von Mays says it can be annoying to deal with.
If the light says green, you have to give it a 5 or maybe 8 second pause before it's really green and then go through, because somebody is apt to just blow through that red light.
Officials say there are three main ways they're trying to tackle the issue: education, enforcement, and engineering. Education is what it sounds like, things like social media public safety campaigns and expanding driver's ed courses in school. Enforcement includes officers handing out reckless driving citations and towing vehicles of repeat reckless driving offenders. But the city has been especially aggressive on engineering. Across Milwaukee, street redesign projects have added features like raised crosswalks, speed humps, curb bumpouts, and protected bike lanes. Some are temporary fixes, like planters and plastic posts. Others are permanent, like concrete curb extensions which narrow the roadway. In 2020, only 46 bumpouts were installed across the city. Last year, that number rose to more than 900. City engineer Kevin Muse says the goal is to reduce speeds.
The faster people go, if they hit something, it's more dangerous. And the faster people go, the more likely they are to hit something.
By the end of this year, Milwaukee will have spent around $170 million on street safety projects since 2020. Muse knows some residents have complained that the changes make it harder to get around the city.
It's not always convenient. It's definitely not convenient what we're doing, right? But it is necessary, I think, if we're going to try to create a safer city for everybody.
At an open house on the city's south side, residents have gathered to share their thoughts on what they want to see done. Every idea is on the table. Some people are in favor of more speed humps. Others want to see a change in state law to allow the city to install red light cameras. But everyone says more needs to be done. Patricia Luevano often rides her bicycle on the city's south side. She says she has to keep a watchful eye out for bad drivers.
And they don't even respect, and you are just so afraid that somebody can hit you.
Milwaukee has recently adopted a Vision Zero plan in an attempt to achieve zero traffic deaths by 2037. Jessica Weinberg is that program's policy director. She thinks that goal is lofty, but attainable.
But it does take all of us deciding we're going to go a little slower, we're going to change how we design our streets, and we're going to think about roads as a place where we show our concern for our community rather than just try to get somewhere as quick as we can.
This month, the city set up a new public dashboard for people to view the progress for themselves. It shows four fatal crashes so far this year across Milwaukee County. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Sled dog racers in Alaska's wilderness must push through bitter cold, sleep deprivation, and changing conditions with the course and their dogs. We explore the experience of mushers with two recent finishers of the Junior Iditarod, and a race organizer is here. And you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Emily Kroll is a board member of the Junior Iditarod Sled Dog Race. Emily, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, and we have 16-year-old McKenna Vanderhoof, who is a dual resident of Wisconsin and Alaska, a junior at Shell Lake High School. McKenna, hello.
Hi.
Yes, and 17-year-old Morgan Martins hails from Brule, Wisconsin, junior at Northwestern High School. Morgan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Morgan, let's start with you. How does it feel after finishing second in this year's Junior Iditarod?
Well, it was a fantastic race, and Junior Iditarod is a race that you'll never forget. It's 150 miles across Alaska with 10 of your best friends, and it's an incredible experience that very few kids will ever have, and it's pretty awesome.
Those 10 dogs are absolutely your best friend during that time. Can you just give us a sense of how alone you can feel out there as you go through this race?
Yeah, the loneliness and the isolation is a pretty huge factor when you're running long distance sled dogs, especially because these 78-mile runs, we do 78 miles, then we rest for 10 hours at a checkpoint, and that's where you see people every now and then, and then we run 78 miles back. And in those 78-mile runs, you are hardly seeing anybody. Like, my 78-mile run home from the halfway checkpoint, I did not see a single other musher. And we were out on the trail for 7.5, 8 hours. So it's a very big factor, and you just got to make do with what you have and just keep pushing forward.
Make do with what you have. McKenna, you finished higher in the rankings this year than last year. How did you feel at the end of the race?
I was very relieved that I finished this year and did a lot better, and I was happy to be able to see my dad and to have finished, and yeah.
When you are out there alone on that race, you know, what goes through your mind? What are you thinking about as you pass those hours?
If I'm being honest, I usually just think of very random things, and my brain kind of just goes all over the place.
Yeah. What do you think is going on with the dogs in this race, and how do you connect with them throughout to know that, you know, that they're doing okay and that you're all together with the same plan?
Yeah. When you give them breaks, you have to go up there, you have to pet them all, make sure they're all doing good, make sure they're not hurting, and usually they're still pretty excited, so you can be excited with them. Mm. And you just have to really know your dogs.
Emily, from the view of organizers, how did this year's race go compared to previous years? I think this was the 47th junior Iditarod.
Yeah, we were pretty fortunate this year. Some years we deal with the different temperature change and kind of right down to the wire of like, okay, are we actually going to be able to have the race here? It's never a question of whether we're able to have the race. We always make sure something happens for the kids. But in different years, we have actually had to either move the start within the general location or in extreme cases, we've had to move it a couple hundred miles north just to make sure it does happen. This year, we had a little bit of a warm-up in the week prior, but nothing that made us concerned about having to move it. So we were definitely fortunate in that aspect. All in all, things went pretty according to plan.
I wonder, is this race like a gateway to the full Iditarod or a gateway to getting teens really hooked on sled dog racing?
Yeah, so it is a qualifier for the Iditarod. Iditarod does have a certain set of standards in which a musher needs to fill out a report card to make sure they're qualified. Junior Iditarod is the youngest 150-mile that would fulfill that report card. We also follow quite similar rules and then our mandatory equipment to make sure the mushers have everything they need on the trail does also mimic that of the Iditarod.
And it's just a lot longer, the full Iditarod.
Yeah, yes, Iditarod is 100 miles. However, our first leg, so our first 75-ish miles, does follow right into the first checkpoint of Iditarod.
I wonder, Morgan, what support does the Junior Iditarod provide to racers to ensure that you stay safe along the way?
There is a lot of support that goes into keeping the junior musher safe and arguably more importantly, keeping the dog safe. So I know the trail crew, the trail boss put out about 1,200 trail markers along the trail. And he did the same thing last year. So he works very hard in making sure that we know the trail and so that we don't go off the trail. Although there have been some cases where mushers are super sleep deprived and it's cold and you just nod off and you miss a trail marker and you take a wrong turn. So they help keep us safe in that manner. And they also provide all the food that we need. We had some sandwiches at the halfway point, and there's also vets at every single checkpoint that we pass through. So Junior Iditarod does a very good job at keeping us and our dogs safe and healthy.
McKenna, how do you feel about mushers like carrying cell phones, for instance, in an emergency?
I think it's a good idea to have it, even though the service doesn't usually allow to make calls. Mm-hmm. But I think it is a good idea for mushers, especially younger ones, to have phones just in case something does go wrong and you need it.
McKenna Vanderhoof there and Morgan Martins. They are two Wisconsin teens recently competed in the Junior Iditarod sled dog race. Emily Kroll is with us, one of the competition's organizers. Call in with a question. Share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A pair of recent finishers of the Junior Iditarod Sled Dog Race share their experiences navigating Alaska's backwoods, alone with their dog team, steering into Arctic blasts and changing course conditions. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Wisconsin teenage mushers McKenna Vanderhoof and Morgan Martins are with us, along with Emily Kroll, Junior Iditarod race organizer. Emily, how do these teens typically prepare for a race like the Junior Iditarod? What is the training regimen like?
Yeah, oftentimes they start in the fall with four-wheeler training. A lot of that is more focused on the shorter runs, building up muscle, and then as we hit snow, we transition over to sled. For some, I know down there, it was a different year with the low snowfall, but thankfully we had good snow up here to make sure the dogs had the miles that they needed.
Yeah, and for the dogs, can they do this immediately, or do they too need to train and gain that mileage?
Yeah, oftentimes it starts with those shorter runs and then building up kind of over the weeks and months. Typically, for the 150-mile race, just like endurance marathon runners, you're not going to need to train an actual 150-mile run. We'll build up typically more to the 40s and 60s, do some overnight camping to make sure not only their bodies are conditioned, but their brains are. Oftentimes you'll see some of the younger dogs, they like to play when it's time to bed down. so that's also something that we need to teach them how to do, how to run rest repeat.
But it's so fun. McKenna, you live in Wisconsin most of the year. How does being here in Wisconsin affect your training for the Junior Iditarod?
My dad has our dogs up in Alaska, so unless I go up there for a holiday or just for whatever, I can't train the dogs. So I have to try to train my body. So I have to go to the gym, and you also have to train your mind, because it's definitely a mind game doing the Junior Iditarod. You have to be really strong mentally. So I just have to find any way that I can strengthen me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
How do you gain the trust and the rapport with the dogs and ensuring that they trust you and follow you?
Most of my dogs that I run, I've had for quite a while. So I just have to use the time that I'm with them, and I have to just do everything to spend time with them, to feed them, to play with them, to show them that they can trust me, so then I can also trust them.
Morgan, how have you trained for the Junior Iditarod?
Yeah, I live in Wisconsin full time, and we have our own kennel of 30 dogs at our house. So I'm training with these dogs from fall, or we start training in fall, and then we train all fall and all winter for races down in the lower 48. And then Ryan Reddington, who was the 2023 Iditarod champion, he had his dogs on our property when he lives part-time in Wisconsin. So I was able to train with Ryan every single day, along with training my own team. So I was able to get very close with Ryan's dogs, and Ryan's team is the team that I used in Junior Iditarod. So it's a very high class team, and I was able to get really close with the dogs, and they were able to get really close to me. So I built very good relationships with both my own team and Ryan's team. And like McKenna said, Junior Iditarod is a very mentally straining race. You deal with sleep deprivation and just exhaustion, and you're out on the trail for 26 to 30 hours or even longer sometimes, and you hardly get any sleep along with the winter conditions. I know it was 15 or so below when we were heading back from the halfway point. So if you're not properly prepared for the pain and the mental struggle, so to say, of the race, that can be very difficult to get through.
We're talking about sled dog racing with two Wisconsin teens who recently completed the Junior Iditarod. McKenna Vanderhoof is here, Morgan Martins, and race organizer Emily Kroll. Emily, you know, just the amount of equipment and the dogs and their needs, how do these teens, how can they do it? Do they fundraise? Do they find sponsorships in order to do the sport?
Yeah, so each team, it kind of is up to them how they're able to fund themselves. Different kennels, some are a bit more homegrown. It's a family-owned operation where it's funded through smaller partnerships, whether it's local businesses or just family itself. Some are actual Iditarod kennels, so they have a little bit more of the larger sponsorships. And then kind of on our side of things, we are a nonprofit, so everything we do, it's when we're not in the active part of getting ready to put on the race, there's so much sponsorship and fundraising going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. In our final moments together, how do you feel about the future of this sport amid climate change?
You know, in general, I've seen kind of some ups and downs over the years. We've had as low as 7 participants, and that wasn't too long ago, and there was definitely some nerves behind it. Things seemed a little bit more bleak, but in recent years, it's definitely been growing for us. This year we had 21 participants, and I just see it getting better from here. It's super exciting to see different teams come out of the woodwork and just watch them grow.
Well, thank you all for joining us. That is Emily Kroll, board member of the Junior Iditarod Sled Dog Race, McKenna Vanderhoof, a dual resident of Wisconsin and Alaska, a junior at Shell Lake High School, and Morgan Martins from Brule, Wisconsin, a junior at Northwestern High School. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a caller-only program, and thanks to our producers, we have hundreds of guests each year who bring their knowledge, they bring their experience to share with Wisconsin and beyond. And a number of these guests, they come directly from your suggestions. So we want to know, who do you want to hear from? What are your ideas for future segments this spring? Join in this caller only at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Helene in Lake Delton starts us off. Helene, hello.
Hi there, Kate. Nice to talk to you.
Yes, and likewise.
I would like to hear a program as comprehensive person, a guest that you could get on to talk about recycling. I guess probably in particular plastics, but the whole thing is important that we do it right. And I'm wondering why the manufacturers aren't being required or aren't jumping on the bandwagon to make more of their wrappings and that sort of thing. When I say wrappers, I mean, for instance, the bags that maybe cookies, but snacks and that sort of thing come in. You know, you eat it up and you look at the bag and it can't be recycled because it's multi-layered.
Do you find that you're confused by what can be recycled and what can't?
Well, yes, I recycle everything that says I can, but I can't put in something like a bag that has got the foil on the inside. And another thing would be cardboard. You can recycle cereal boxes and other types of boxes that are colored on the one side, but they have the just plain gray cardboard color on the inside. But if it were to be a shiny interior,
That's different. Yes. Well, Helene, I appreciate that. And really trying to dig down into understanding recycling of plastics and cardboard and why manufacturers, as Helene says, perhaps make it more difficult for us to be able to navigate what is actually being recycled. Thank you for that suggestion. Ken now in Black River Falls is here. Ken, hello.
Good morning. I enjoy your show, and I'd like to suggest some dog cognition, a canine cognition show. There's been a lot of recognition of that. There's a tremendous amount of research about it, and dogs are a lot more aware than we think. So are wolves, frankly. And I think it would be very interesting to go into what's going on in your dog's mind, what your dog knows, sees, and what the dog thinks.
How they solve problems, how they make decisions, and really getting into that canine psychology.
How they evaluate people as well.
Okay, yes.
There's an old saying, you can't fool puppy dogs or children. And that seems to be true. And I'd love to find somebody that really could talk about it. I remember once asking my veterinarian up in Osseo, I said, how is it possible my dog understands me so well? And she said, simple. They've been watching us for 20,000 years. What else do they have to do?
Have you been a dog owner most of your life?
Yes. Recently, I had a dog for 16 years. Oh. And I will tell you that when you live with any animal, any person for that long, every day, you develop your boundaries. You understand each other. You know when one wants to be getting attention or not. You can do something like, oh, I'll arrange your bed to make it more comfortable. The dog would look at me and say, oh, great, and go back and arrange it the way she wanted it.
We know who's in charge. Simple. Absolutely. And same can be said for cats in our household. Well, Ken, appreciate the call so much and exploring canine cognition, what is possible, and really what is happening in the psychology of dogs. We're exploring compelling ideas here on The Morning Show, what we should cover next. It is a caller-only program, and we're gathering up all your show ideas and the topics you think could use further discussion, like recycling, like canine cognition. What topics or issues are important to you? Be part of this caller-only program. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Chris in Port Wing, who has something for us. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for this. It's fun to be able to add in topics. I think you should have a guest named Simon Sharp, whose recent book in 2023 is called Five Times Faster. It's about the United Kingdom's success in reducing their national carbon footprint, especially with reference to their electrical utility generation, which they managed to reduce the carbon footprint 8 times faster than the average developed nation. And it's a great upbeat book about what we can do to help mitigate climate change.
Does it look at large-scale problems, or does it dive into more of also household ways to reduce the carbon footprint?
Well, for those of us that have been studying this for the last 30 years, we know that institutional change is what's really going to make a difference. Small incremental changes on the personal level are very important, but, you know, 80% of the carbon footprint is being dictated to us by the way we generate electricity, the way we transport ourselves and our goods, the way that we go ahead and make steel and cement. And these major changes, which we have to tackle, are only going to be taken on the large scale.
Well, appreciate the author's suggestion in Simon Sharp, the book Five Times Faster. We will check it out. And Chris, thank you so much for listening and contributing to the morning show. And we're hearing from you, your show suggestions. Email them our way to ideas@wpr.org. In January, Jen from Eau Claire called in and asked for a show about legislation that would regulate at-home baking businesses, and we talked about that measure with Joby Murray, board president of the Wisconsin Cottage Food Association.
Yeah, so the bill actually limits us up to $20,000. So we would be able to run our businesses out of our homes up to $20,000. Once we hit a $20,000 revenue cap, then it'd be up to the state to determine what those next steps were. And the bill isn't clear as to what that looks like. So it could be maybe as simple as like a regulation that or an inspection, but it could be something like requiring us to have a commercial kitchen after the $20,000 cap. So it would really limit our abilities as home bakers to run profitable businesses out of our homes and utilizing our available resources of our home kitchens. So that's a really big, the bill was just very unclear on a lot of different things, but the revenue cap was really the biggest sticking point for us.
That is Joby Murray, and you can read more about the bill and lawsuits over the state's regulation of home baked goods at WPR.org. We are opening up the lines to find out where you want to take the morning show next, and let's talk about the programming you want to hear this spring and into the future at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Join in on the questions you want us to explore, the kind of programming that would help you and your family. Be part of this. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's a morning show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's a caller-only program. It's dedicated to you and what you want to bring to these Wisconsin conversations. So what are your ideas for future programs and segments? Which shows have you enjoyed the most and why? Email your ideas to ideas@wpr.org. Georgiana is listening this morning, shared a show idea over email, and Georgiana voiced appreciation for today's segment on the Junior Iditarod and advocated for more conversations with mushers. Georgiana says a son spent a year working with a musher in Alaska and is now working as a dog sled tour guide in Sweden. Oh, that's amazing. And Georgiana says there are more mushers with Wisconsin ties. Thank you for that suggestion and carrying that conversation forward. Let's go to Jeff in Madison now. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. The topic that I would like to suggest is the rare disease called amyloidosis. Maybe 5,000-7,000 people per year contact amyloidosis. The main kind, AL amyloidosis, is always fatal. Mm-hmm. There is no cure. My wife was diagnosed in March of 2008. Mm. Typically, back then, people would live maybe a year and a half, something like that. With the treatment from the hematology department, UW Health, main hospital, namely with Elliot, Dr. Elliot Williams. He kept her going with basically the same treatments that are used for cancer.
Okay.
For nearly 14 years.
Where did you find support groups to help in this rare disease?
This main support group is one. It's located in Chicago. It's simply called the Amyloidosis Support Group. And I can furnish information about that if you wanted to follow up later.
Well, thank you for shedding light on this rare disease, amyloidosis, and this buildup that can make the organs not work properly. Jeff, appreciate you bringing that to the table. Kathy is next in Jacksonport. Kathy, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I heard the gentleman express the idea about having someone to talk about dog psychology. And I think what people would love to hear about as well is pet food ingredients.
Oh.
I think that it's very confusing to know what ingredients mean if you try to read the back of the bag. Mm. And I think that pet foods, especially dog foods, I think have some really dangerous ingredients in them. So I think since so many of us are dog and cat owners, we would love to be educated on what we really should be feeding our animals.
Do your animals have preferences that you can notice with their food?
They do, but animals, just like humans, don't always have the best preferences. I mean, if you give a human a choice to eat McDonald's, you know, they may choose to eat that, even though it's not the best thing for them.
Yeah.
I once had a person tell me the best food for a cat is mouse in a can.
Okay. So, but
that's really what they should eat.
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, understanding the backs of the labels, the pet food ingredients and how to navigate those labels and know what is the best option for your pet. It sounds like a veterinarian might be able to help us out. Kathy, thank you so much for that suggestion. As we collect these future show ideas, and you can call in with your topic suggestion at 800-642-1234 or email that suggestion our way, email ideas@wpr.org. This month, Gary from Duluth called during a conversation about municipal waste incinerators, and Gary asked how Wisconsin power plants are handling toxic mercury after a Minnesota incinerator closed following problems with mercury. And here is Lauren Wentz, who teaches a DNR-certified course on waste incinerators.
Through the air pollution control process, the addition of activated carbon to adsorb the mercury atoms will effectively neutralize the mercury and not make it, and at that point, it's unable to get back into the environment in its harmful form. Mm-hmm. So, again, that becomes part of the ash that's collected and disposed of in a monofill at a landfill. There are issues. I mean, there have been issues nationwide and even worldwide with toxic materials like mercury sort of escaping from the incineration process. But in a well-run, well-monitored facility, it's not necessarily a concern.
That is Lauren Wentz, as we learned about waste incinerators and that ability to get rid of waste or at least condense it down before it goes further to landfill. You can join in with topics you wish to explore. This is a caller-only program as we gather up all your show ideas and the topics that you think could use further discussion. Be part of it. Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ron in Manitowoc County is here. Ron, hi.
Oh, good morning. Thank you. Perhaps a program on the use of burn barrels to dispose of individual waste which is illegal in Wisconsin, but you see a great deal of it and you smell more of it. Thank you.
Burn barrels. And do you find that, Ron, is this a rural area issue, or do you also see it in more suburban areas?
Well, I guess in the area which we reside, we tend to see it if it does exist.
Mm-hmm,
but people use that method to socialize their waste disposal, which affects all of us. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ron. Thank you so much for listening and for contributing. In February, we talked with a panel of journalists and scholars about the importance of Black media in Wisconsin. And at one point, we asked the editor of the Milwaukee Community Journal about challenges generating revenue from the newspaper. So here's Thomas Mitchell, Jr.
It's always been a challenge. As long as I've been at the Community Journal, it's been a challenge to get advertisers to advertise. For a while, because of George Floyd and his emphasis on DEI, it was a little easier. But everybody has withdrawn now that some years have passed. You see these companies take retreat on DEI. And even during the Floyd situation, the advertising really didn't increase much for Black media. And this is really a problem even with political ads, trying to get them to spend money with the Black press in order to get the message out about their candidate. Businesses and even some organizations want you to have put their press release in, but they don't want to advertise.
That is Thomas Mitchell, Jr. of the Milwaukee Community Journal. Let's bring in Karen now in Oshkosh. Karen, hi. What topic would you like to bring up?
I would like to hear about mega churches.
And what aspect of mega churches would intrigue you for a conversation?
Well, I'm curious about them. Who pays for these? They seem to be on, you know, really big properties and they're beautiful structures. What religions do they serve? How and why and when did they become so popular?
And perhaps how active are they in Wisconsin?
Yes. Yeah. Along Highway 41 in Appleton, there's a couple of them, and they're just huge.
Well, Karen, thank you for bringing that topic to the attention here. And another listener is suggesting a show on the impact to communities and neighborhoods from Airbnbs, and that suggestion came by email. Mark now in De Pere has something for us. Mark, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I'm really interested in foreign tourism. I just read recently that 50 million tourist visas were given out in 2022 to foreign visitors. We really depend a lot on tourism in Wisconsin, and even to get the workers we need for the tourism industry. I know in Door County, they used to have quite a number of visas, work visas, for foreign young people. And yet, in our rural communities, we have a lot of xenophobia and fear, and some people even demanding that we have extreme vetting of people. And yet that would affect our tourism industry, extreme vetting of visas for tourism, and cut down on that 50 million tourist visas.
Well, Mark, thank you for bringing that suggestion as we look more closely at foreign travelers coming to our communities and what scrutiny that entails and how to create welcoming spaces for tourists from abroad. We're collecting your future show ideas. Send them our way. Email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get those ideas flowing in for this caller-only program where your suggestions for future segments, they're the topic of conversation. And along the way, we recall these great discussions with guests and memorable on-air moments. And your participation is so important here. Let's hear what programs you want us to put together this spring and what do you want to learn more about? What deserves more time and attention? Join in this caller-only program. The number is 800-642-1234. Email your show ideas to ideas@wpr.org. Kurt in Columbia County is here. Hello, Kurt.
Good morning. Here's a suggestion. I live in Columbia County, and as we know, the Columbia 1 and 2 power plant, coal-fired, is about to convert from coal burning in a year or so to solar power. And it's very evident for us that live in this area of all the rooftops show evidence of acid rain from the long time burning. I'd like to see the resources of public radio do maybe an ongoing report of how the changeover goes and any cleanup of toxins in the soil goes from coal-powered to solar power, and that's my comment.
Kurt, thank you. So the ongoing process of winding down these coal-powered power plants in Wisconsin and that transition to solar and green energy for going to the grid. Kurt, thank you for that. And
thank you.
Yeah, so we'll look more into that. Let's go to Melissa now in Madison. Melissa, hi.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, one of my suggestions for an ideas topic is kind of the state of government funding in Wisconsin towards public schools. You know, from what we understand is that many districts in Wisconsin now are going to referendum. So the community is asking for more funding because there is a gap. The state has not been contributing along the cost of living adjustments throughout the year. So there's a gap then, mm-hmm. and the schools are at risk of having to cut a number of programs as a result of this, such as mental health programs, behavioral health programs, special education programs. And, you know, I understand in a couple communities that, you know, referendums have been no votes by the taxpayers because they're just saying, you know, we can only pay so much. Just, you know, inflation has, you know, gone up. And, you know, what is the state doing with that, you know, funding that schools could otherwise have rather than going to referendum? So, you know, the districts also say that, you know, it's to keep up with competition for teachers. You know, they want good quality teachers, you know, teaching our young children. And, you know, there's a lot of competition there. So,
Melissa,
you know,
do you feel?
Do you
feel that homeowners on their property taxes are expected to close these funding gaps?
That's what the referendums are saying, that yes, due to the lack of funding, they're going to the communities and asking to increase property taxes. And, you know, just within one district over the course of 5 years, they're asking for almost $10 million for taxpayers to cover. And it's just, people are saying it's just not possible. Look, we care about our public schools. We want children to succeed. We need these, you know, special needs resources more than ever with the state of mental health. And unfortunately, if they don't get, you know, these funding, some of those programs are going to unfortunately have to be, you know, canceled. So, you know, what can be done at the state level to switch back that model of you know, the state government funding public schools along with the cost of inflation.
Melissa,
not happening.
Thank you so much for bringing that this morning, rebalancing the funding formula, especially in light of inflation, as we look at where the funding for public schools is coming from as the costs continue to mount. Thank you for joining in, Melissa. Nancy now in Grafton is here. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. When you mentioned about having a referendum, you know, for raising taxes, well, that's happening here in Grafton, too. But I got to say one thing. I have to say that at our high school here, we have a class where people can go to learn to be automotive
mechanics.
Specials. Yeah, and I'm telling you, ours has been the number one in the country. Our teachers have been absolutely fantastic to teach young people how to do mechanics. And I think that not only mechanics should be available, there should also be for culinary art, healthcare, so many different things that you can learn, plumbing, electricians, you know, learn to work with your hands. You can always have a job. And one thing else I'd like to say is when we have all these little startup schools here, you know, and somebody decides, oh, we're going to start a school up. Well, how long do they get help, you know, from the state, but how long do they get all this money? But then they close down. That's it. Mm. So I think that should be kind of looked upon a little bit about all these little startup schools.
Nancy, thank you for those two suggestions, one being how the trades are taught in high schools in particular, Nancy showcasing a mechanics course in a local high school, and then the startup of schools and how those get up and running. What does success look like for a new school in a community? Thank you for those suggestions. Carol now in Milwaukee is here. Carol, hello.
Hello. I'd like to know more about what's going on in the city of Milwaukee where I live. We don't have much newspaper anymore. It's very expensive to buy the journal, and I just don't know what's going on the way we used to. And I know it would be very hard for your station probably to keep us informed, but some information would be nice. And it should be objective, though, and maybe politicians might know what's going on, but would they tell us everything? You know, I don't know. So,
do you think more of a direct line to city council meetings, more of the discussions that are going on there?
Yeah. Or information as to what is going on there.
Okay.
Even what are the questions they're taking up? What are the opinions of different politicians? Anything like that, yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Carol, thank you so much calling in from Milwaukee, looking more deeply into the local community and the developments there from City Council. Gary now in Brookfield has an idea. Gary, go ahead.
Hello, Kate. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And what I was interested in knowing is early on Sunday mornings, WPR has a show called On the Media. This past week's show, the last half of the show was really about the future of K-12 education. And they talked to an expert. I think she was a lady from Yale or Rutgers. And she said that where things are going, there will no longer be public schools for K-12. That K-12 education is going to become privatized, similar to the way we pay for people to go to college now. People pay for it on their own. Hmm. And she said that that's the future of it. And I'm interested in hearing some people in education in Wisconsin talk about that. I mean, if you go and listen to the last 15 minutes of the show that was on Sunday morning.
Let me ask you this, Gary. How did that make you feel when you heard that segment?
I don't like it. I don't like it at all, because I thought one of the greatest things about my education in Wisconsin was being exposed to people from all different cultures, from all different ethnicities, from all different levels of wealth.
Mm.
And I thought that was one of the most educating things in my life and helped me long-term in my career.
Gary, thank you for calling in. And about the concerns that Gary sees about privatizing K-12 schools and a recent conversation about that on the program on the media. Appreciate you bringing that to us, Gary. Let's see here. A couple more show suggestions from the email inbox. One listener suggests talking about over-the-counter birth control pills that could become available this year. Allison also suggests an economics program about the rise of wedding and event-related businesses like photographers, videographers, planners, and coordinators. Thank you so much for those suggestions. Now let's go to Steve in Trigo. Steve, hi. Go ahead.
Good morning. I would suggest as a guest, assistant professor of sociology, Esther Sullivan from the University of Colorado. She recently published a book titled Manufactured Insecurity, Mobile Home Parks and Americans' Tenuous Right to Place. And it's about the trend nationwide of private equity firms buying up manufactured home communities and then abruptly raising rents and fees and often poorly managed, and it's pricing a lot of our most vulnerable neighbors and citizens out of their homes.
What led you to read this book?
Well, I've become interested lately in the move to turn manufactured home communities into cooperatives to prevent that from happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a movement that's springing up in various parts of the country. And it's one that should happen here in Wisconsin. There are over 1,200 manufactured home communities in Wisconsin with maybe a population of roughly 200,000 people living in those communities.
Well, Steve,
so I think
yeah.
It's a larger part of the affordable housing crisis.
Uh-huh.
But in this instance, it tends to really adversely affect low-income people, elderly people, and people with disabilities.
Steve, thank you so much for shining a light on that aspect of housing and mobile home communities, who owns them, and their future. You're with us for a caller-only program as we gather up your interests for future segments this spring, and we listen back to conversation highlights. What do you think should be getting more attention in these times? What do you want people to know about? Drop us a line, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We invite your ideas for future segments on this caller-only program. And really, the ideas, they're endless on what could make a segment. In recent days, we've talked about state politics, shipwrecks, theater, tax season, the business of making wool. We're looking out for your email of show topics to ideas at WPR.org. And Cynthia sent a few show ideas to the inbox. Cynthia suggests conversations with Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Cynthia would like to better understand opposing political views and suggested hearing from Republicans. Cynthia, thank you for that, for reaching out on politics. Eric in Waukesha also emailed, and Eric suggests covering the Midwest Gaming Classic. It's a gaming convention in downtown Milwaukee the first weekend of April. And Eric says the conversation would feature video games, pinball, board games, retro equipment, cosplay, merchants, and much more fun. Eric, thank you so much for putting that on the radar. Let's go back to the phones now with Rich in Rhinelander with a suggestion. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thanks. Two professors at University of Wisconsin, one's named Wei, W-E-I, that's how I pronounce it. The other, Q-I-N, I'd probably pronounce that Quinn, but I may be wrong about that. are operating under a Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute investigation of which plastics in the Great Lakes Basin dissolve into nanoplastics, which enter our bodies. Another possible person is Phoebe Stapleton at Rutgers University. We are recycling plastics, but we're recycling them through our bodies. And I want a lot of discussion about what's happening and if there's anything we can do about it.
The outlook on microplastics and nanoplastics as they enter our waterways and our bodies. Rich, thank you so much for that. Paul in Waukesha County is next. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm interested in finding out more about how charter schools are funded. I've heard rumors that at the beginning of the school year, the charter schools encourage all sorts of people to be there. And then the school funding, the payment is set up after the, I think it's the third Friday attendance records. And then lots of public schools are suddenly experiencing kids being sent back to the public schools from the charter schools, but the funding remains the same for the rest of the year, which in effect gives the charter schools more money per student and the public schools less money per student. And so I didn't know if there was a better way to determine how to fund or share the funding with charter schools.
Some type of real-time funding system dependent on where that child is. So looking more deeply at how the finances work in the charter school models and just some fact-checking perhaps as well, Paul, on how the charter schools operate. Thank you so much. Larry in Prairie du Chien is here. Larry, hi.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I would like to see an expert come on that would try to explain the funding that we give to, for instance, Ukraine. Let's say, for example, if we give $100 million, what percentage of that money actually stays in the United States, providing jobs here? I understand that that money is used to buy, for instance, ammunition from manufacturers here in our country or from our supplies. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have to turn around and pay manufacturers to replace that in our stock. So, in essence, we actually are providing jobs here in our country with that money. So I would like to see...
Following the money on Ukraine and these aid programs and how much of it is tied back to the United States and helping companies here as well. Larry, thank you for that exploration. Lyric now in Blanchardville. Lyric, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, the Biden administration, fortunately, forgave student loans that have been pending for thousands and tens of thousands of students across the U.S. Wisconsin is one of four states who have not forgiven the tax on those student loan forgiveness. And when you're forgiven your student loan, you owe the state of Wisconsin tax like you got paid that money. And the problem is when you go online and try to do research or even call anybody to find out something, they'll say one thing in the legislature and then directly below it will be another item in, that's a ruling. That's its opposite. It's a bunch of gobbledygook. Somebody needs to make sense out of this. I cannot be the only graduate student out of tens of thousands of people. And Wisconsin always has great students from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and a lot of them go on to other universities and get even PhDs if they haven't gotten them from Madison.
It sounds like you have been impacted by the federal loan forgiveness program.
Yes, and Wisconsin is only one of four states out of all 50 states in the U.S. to expect the students to pay this next tax cycle in the next week or so? How do you fill out those forms when one item says this and the other item and says it's opposite? It's unbelievable.
All right. So definitely needing an explainer there. Lyric, thank you for bringing that to our attention as we explore your show ideas, the topics that you really want to see us cover. There's still time to talk. There's still time to suggest. The number is 800-642-1234. And last week, we had a wide-ranging conversation about in vitro fertilization with Dr. Elizabeth Pritz from the Wisconsin Fertility Institute in Middleton. We talked about the recent Alabama Supreme Court ruling that blocked IVF treatment in that state, and we discussed access to IVF in Wisconsin. Here's part of our conversation about the cost of treatment.
Right now, depending on where you are in the country, the cost ranges upwards of $10,000 to $20,000 per IVF cycle. And that doesn't include the $5,000 to $10,000 that it costs for the medications. But, you know, it's not just the financial cost. It's also the emotions connected to this whole process. And it's the emotions connected to how are we going to come up with this money? And when I did IVF about 20 years ago, I was a brand new doc, and I was still in quite a bit of debt from medical school. And so my husband and I had to take out a loan in order for me to have IVF treatment.
That is Dr. Elizabeth Pritz, one of our recent guests from the Wisconsin Fertility Institute. And don't forget, you can still visit our program page. You can fill out a quick two-question form to share more with us about your show ideas. Find us there at WPR.org/mornings. And thank you so much for your ideas and contributions that roll into the morning show. We're listening to them. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.